This week on the Boag World Show, we talk about applying UX principles to team collaboration, editorial calendars, and Northern cuisine. This week's show is sponsored by Proposify and Teacup Analytics. Welcome to the Boag World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul Boag and joining me on this week's show is Shahina Patel, Marcus Lillington, Ryan Taylor and Andy Clark. Hello all.
Hello.
Morning, Paul.
So, Shahina, you are our Sam Barnes for the day.
Yes, I am.
I don't know that could have possibly been the rudest thing I've ever said to anyone. I apologize for that.
That's fine. We'll see how this goes, and I will decide how much offense to take by the end.
Oh, don't do that, Gordon.
No, always take offense at the beginning. Yeah, that's absolutely how we operate.
Things only get worse. Really. Well,
Sam is known as the sensible one, so. I'm not quite sure whether you're going to be sensible or not. You sound like you're a bit sensible, especially compared to Paul and Andy.
Yeah, I think most people who know me will tell you I am really rather sensible. Yeah.
Oh no.
Keep us in order.
That sounds. If someone said that to me, it would feel like the biggest insult ever, being described as the sensible one. Yeah. But I suppose if you're sensible, that sounds like a compliment.
Exactly.
Do I detect a bit of a northern twang there, Chuck?
Me?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Well, what do you mean by northern? Where are you from?
Well, I'm from Lancashire.
Aha. Uh-huh. Oh, okay. Right. It's a proper north then. Yes.
Oh, yeah. I'm not talking about, you know, Milton Keynes. That's not north.
No. Well, some people think anything north of Birmingham is north when obviously we know that it's not.
No.
That is practically south, yeah. I'm currently hailing from Manchester, but before that I was in Lancaster, so just up the road. What about you?
I was born in Morecambe.
Oh, really? Oh, sorry about that. Did you grow up there?
Paul and Marcus have never heard of Morecambe.
Yeah, oh. Eric?
Well, you've heard of Eric
Morecambe.
I believe it was named after him, was it not?
He named himself after Morecambe. His real name was Eric Bartholomew.
Okay.
Was it really?
It was, yeah.
I don't know whether to believe you anymore.
Take it as read. Just take that fact straight down to the pub. You don't need to check it and just tell as many people as possible.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah. See, you're not the sensible one.
So you move south. You move south to Manchester.
That's right, yeah. And it's all right, you know.
It's not bad.
No, they've got chippies with curry and gravy, so, you know, that's
the important thing. You lose that the further south you go.
Exactly, yeah. And then, I mean, it's obviously not as good as the chippies in Lancaster because that has the best one. But, you know, they're not far behind, I will admit.
So the big
test. Can you understand anything that's being said, Paul?
I have no idea what's going on.
Well, here's the thing, right? Shahina, what do you call a bread thing?
It's a bomb. I know what you're going to ask. It's a bomb.
It's a
what?
A bomb. Yeah.
Let's not get into this. It's definitely a bomb.
What's a bomb?
Who wants to take this?
How do you spell bomb?
B-A-R-M.
Barm.
Barm.
A barm.
A barn, like you keep cows in.
Yeah.
No, with an M on the
an
end.
M.
A barm.
Right. So is this like
a
let
barm?
Let Shahina say, seeing as she's new, and hello Shahina, we haven't met. Tell us about barms.
So a barm is the thing that you put your chips in when you
what,
have
like a wrapper?
A chip barm. No, because you eat the barm.
A plastic container, no. You eat the barm.
That's right, yeah, it's a bread product.
Oh, okay, a roll.
No. You might know it as one of those, but that's, you know, that's slightly incorrect because it is a barm.
So it's a roll.
It's It can be a role if you want it to be a role.
Is it in any way different from a role?
Yeah, I'd say it's superior just by having the correct name.
Okay, but it's a role.
I've been around for so many years and I've never heard that before.
No.
Honestly, have you guys not come north of, Coventry?
I used to do work for Lancaster Uni, but I don't remember anybody saying that to me.
Yeah, but let's face it, Marcus, you know, if we have to go north, we get in and out as quick as possible, don't we? I mean, you don't hang around. You certainly don't talk to northerners.
I try not to.
When I first met my wife, she said to me, first year we were together, she says, "Shall we go up to the feast?" And I went, What's the feast?
It's tur. I've got a problem with. What's tur?
It's a feast. And I went, did anyone know what she meant by when she said, "Shall we go up to the feast?"
No.
Up to the fair?
Fair?
Yeah.
What? Oh. What, as in fun fair?
And people who work at the fair are feasties.
Hey,
no, they're not.
By fair, you don't happen to mean Morecambe's now shut down Pleasureland, do you? Oh, no, it's Blackpool Pleasureland. What was it called? Frontierland. Do you remember that?
Frontierland. Oh, I loved that when I was a kid. I loved it. In fact, I really wanted to buy one of the big fiberglass cowboys, but you can't buy them.
I feel like I've lost control of this podcast.
I was about to say, Paul, please can you bring this back online?
I am so sleep deprived and so tired that none of this is making sense to me at the moment. I feel like I'm in some kind of alternate reality.
And it's not just the accents, you mean, it's the content as well.
The accents are obviously a huge problem. Although none of you lot are as bad as at Headscape, we hired a developer, Chris Henderson.
I swear
to you, when he first joined the company, I didn't understand a word he said. It was so embarrassing. I'd have to ask him about five times.
You know,
where's he from?
He's from Sunderland way up north, northeast. He's probably rolling his eyes as I speak now. But a couple of weeks ago, we went to Washington. Chris was the developer on the project.
Oh, that must have been funny.
The Americans did keep looking at him strangely and like, what did he say? But then they talk funny as well, so, you know.
Well, Paul and Marcus are outnumbered this
week. For the first time ever,
being soft, shandy-drinking southerners down there.
Proud.
So, and so we should basically just keep using the northern colloquialisms and they won't know what on earth we're talking
about. I had to go north. Does Bradford count as north? Is that north?
I was born in Bradford.
Yeah.
I got this panicked text from my wife. She went to visit friends. This was on Friday, saying she dislocated her ankle.
Ooh, ow.
Yeah,
that's,
I know.
That's proper ow.
So I had to drive or get myself to Bradford because, of course, she couldn't drive home then. So I had to go north then. And it was full of northern people talking. And it was really stereotypical. The further north the train went, right, I started in Bristol. By about Manchester, it started filling up with progressively more drunk people. I'm telling you, it's true.
Maybe it was just later in the day, Paul?
Yeah, I think that was probably it, to be fair. But that's not the point. So, yeah.
Did she drive?
I couldn't drive because she had the car. So, you know, I had to actually sit next to northerners. It was quite distressing.
Is she all right?
But you drove back?
Yeah, I drove back. Yeah.
So you drove back in your Paul Diesel car?
Yes, I did. Oh, you did. I walked right into that.
You did.
So, Shahina, they've all decided that I look like Vin Diesel, which I take as a huge compliment.
Quite correct. You look like...
No. Let's stop. Let's just stop at that point.
Was it a shriveled Vin Diesel?
Yeah.
I think...
Like a shriveled Vin Diesel, that's it. Yeah. Vin Diesel has been popped.
So, yes, so she dislocated her ankle and then popped it back in.
Ooh, wow.
Because she didn't want to wait around for the hospital. That's how hardcore my wife is. You don't mess with her. That's the third time she's done that.
Well, if she knows
not her ankle. It was previously her knee. And every time she just puts it back in herself, it sickens me.
Yeah, that would make me feel a bit, ooh, I've seen somebody do it with their shoulder, and it's like, oh, no. Blah.
Nasty.
Yeah.
Nasty, nasty, nasty.
Touched lots of sort of fake wood.
Yes.
But it's not going to happen to me.
So, yes. Well, I mean, you must be at the age, Marcus, where it could be a hip.
Oh, yeah. I ought to book myself in. I can't decide whether to go for the left or the right one first. That makes that... But I keep forgetting Andy's a year older than me.
Shh.
Don't tell Shahina that. She might think that I'm, you know, young and trendy.
No, she won't.
You're neither of those things, Andy.
Exactly. Right, okay. I think we ought to actually push on with the show, because this has been an intro recorded in 23 parts, as we've had such problems getting the recording working. So let's move on and actually do something useful. Let's talk about Teacup Analytics, which is our sponsor.
Go on, then.
Who've supported the whole season, so you've got to give them a big loving hug.
It's amazing.
Yeah, that's very nice. So Teacup Analytics is essentially reporting that's built on top of Google Analytics. So it takes all the complexity of Google Analytics and makes it easy to understand in a series of useful reports. And I think it's easy to kind of underestimate analytics and the importance of analytics, because, let's be honest, as somebody who runs an agency or as a freelancer, Google Analytics used right and Google Analytics reporting can lead to recurring revenue for you, because when you get good analytics reports, it kind of highlights opportunities to help you grow your clients' businesses, whether through search engine optimization or performance or mobile-first design or simply making small changes to navigation or whatever. That the data that you can get out of these reports highlights where things need to be improved and where effort is best focused. And that, of course, leads to repeat business. And also those kind of data-backed decisions lead to, you know, turn out to be more effective for clients. So they see the value of the work you're doing, because as you do it, you can see the results of it. And Teacup Analytics provides that kind of data. So all of this eventually will lead to more billable hours and a happier client, because they can see measurable results and a return for the investment they put into it. So everybody wins, really. So you can find out more about Teacup Analytics by going to boag.world/ /. Oh, a slushy. I could eat a slushy, drink a slushy. What do you eat or drink a slushy?
I think you drink them.
Yeah. You sit yourself.
You commit yourself to it.
No, submit.
Okay. So boag.world/teacup. There you go. Right, let's get on to some talking points for this week. Marcus, you missed out last week, so I thought you could go first. What have you got for us?
Okay, I have got... This is from... a message came in from Greg Robertson, and his message was as... this, basically. Sorry, getting distracted by people outside in the office. Love the show, which is a nice way to start. Been listening for years.
I'm sorry, Greg. That's very unfortunate.
For years. Yeah. Years and years. It's not quite as bad as having to do it for years, well, but there you go. I often listen while working. You guys are entertaining and informative. I get a lot of tips and news on latest design / developer tools from you all.
Do you think he's getting confused with another podcast?
It might be, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Anyway.
Moving on. I know you've done it in the past, or I think you have, but could you do a show on hiring employees for small businesses? Well, I'm not going to do a whole show, but I might do 5 minutes.
That's our level of commitment. Yeah.
We're committed here. I've been a graphic designer for 32 years, long time, and have been designing websites for about 20. However, I've pretty much been doing it on my own. I desperately need to hire someone to help, at least with the small, tedious things, but I can't seem to bring myself to do it. I must be scared or just cheap, ha ha. Maybe it's a fear of not having enough business, even though I've been overloaded with clients for years, working crazy hours just to keep up. I could really use some help, or maybe just some advice from someone who at some point has gone through all what I'm going through. Okay, well, I wrote a few points on that last week, and I just have to kind of remind myself of what they were. The first one was the comment about taking someone on to do the small, tedious things. And I think that depends on what you mean. If you mean a kind of junior to yourself, then I expect you'll get what you pay for. If you want someone to do small, tedious things, i.e. someone who's prepared to do small, tedious things, probably won't add much to your company. However, if you mean someone to kind of help with admin-y tasks, then I guess fair enough. You need to find someone who fits with your ethos, i.e. not necessarily someone who's like you, but just someone who you can kind of trust to get on with the job, if it's just if it's your first hire. I would suggest hiring somebody who has multiple skills rather than a specialist, basically because there's only a small number of you, so if you can if you can cover more bases, then all the better, I would argue. But you need to look for someone with complementary skills to yours. Chris, Paul and myself were very good examples of that way back in the beginning of Headscape, although we soon found out that we didn't have any development skills because Paul was building CMS sites.
And I did that very well for the time.
For the time, yes, you did. But it wasn't your your top skill, and we realised that we needed to get some help there. So yeah, finding somebody complementary to yourself. But I think the big point that you want to know here, or the point that needs to be discussed, is when to hire. And I think the first thing you need to ask yourself is why you want the help, which might be a number of different things, but it may be that you can take on more or more complex work. I think what you're saying is you need to reduce your burden, but it also might be that you're bored of working on your own and you'd like to work with some other people. When we were really small, we would basically take on somebody new if we won a big project. So it would be, which is probably, it seems a crazy thing to say even now, but every time we've decided to do a strategic hire, right, we're going to go into this field and we're going to hire somebody so that we have this extra skill set, and then we can grow and become great because of that. It's never worked. It's only ever worked when we thought, you know what, we've got too much work and we need to hire somebody else, another design developer, whatever. That has always worked. So even though it sounds a bit kind of disorganized, actually, it's been a good thing for us. We have always offered permanent positions. We kind of feel more comfortable doing that. But offering a temporary position might give you a chance to see if this hiring people thing is going to work. But again, you might not really get the person you want if you do that. But final point, and this is a kind of personal thing for me, which is maybe potentially, a bit left field, but if you're scared of taking someone on, I just wanted to make the point that I've always loved the responsibility of having employees. We design agencies in general, but Headscape would be a good example. We don't really bring anything to the world that is, it wouldn't matter if we weren't here, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. So the fact that we're employing people and giving them a living is a really good feeling. So if you're worrying about maybe taking somebody on, actually, it can be a good thing.
I like that. I like that. Do you know, I never thought of it like that.
You have thought of it like that. Yes, you have, because when I was agonising about 4 years ago about whether to take on our first employee, one of the pieces of advice that you gave me was, and it's really great that you'd be giving somebody a living.
Yeah. It's so important in our industry, I think, because we don't really do anything that's that important. We don't save people's lives or provide food or whatever. I'm not saying we're useless, but we provide a service, but the being able to give people employment, I think, is great.
I like that from a reassuring point of view, because I certainly might have said this to you, Andy, which is subtly different, which is the fact that a lot of people worry about, if I take on somebody, then I've got this responsibility for them and I have to keep bringing it. I mean, what if I have to fire them? But I kind of have the attitude, but for however long, you actually gave them a job. Do you see what I mean? You can look at it in the negative of, I might have to take someone's job away, or you can look at it in the positive, in which case I gave them a job for a long length of time.
So absolutely. And
that's a good one.
It's a great one.
Ryan, halfway through that, you were going,
I can't remember exactly what Marcus. I didn't think you were going to pull me in for this.
Sorry, I'm throwing you now.
Marcus said something about. I was. Marcus said something about not strategically hiring, and hiring just when you actually need the resource. Yeah. I would completely agree with that. If you need, me personally, and this is our experience as well, you need to have the work there to give the people to do. But you got to think that if you bring somebody in for a project that you've got to work on, you've increased your resource output, you know. So if you, I don't know how, you know, depending on how you structure your business, we always keep Fridays free for internal and admin and writing blog posts and various bits and pieces. So we kind of book out 4 days a week and then have Fridays for doing internal stuff. If you hire another employee to work on a project that you've just won, you've got another employee that you've in essence got for an entire week every month to work on other things. For internal things and things like that, so you increase your internal productivity as well. But you've got to have the work there to be able to maintain them. Mm. And work can be very fleeting. You can suddenly have so much stuff that, you know, how are we going to get all this stuff done? And no matter how much strategy you put into it, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to find the work. So if you hire somebody without the work for them to do, and then you spend 3 months trying to find work for them to do, then you've got to let go of them. That's an horrible position to be in. So I was just agreeing with Marcus when I was in the middle.
I see. It was mmming. I thought it was disagreeing, but you were actually agreeing.
No. I was agreeing. Okay.
Sheena, how big is the agency you work for?
Well, Sigma in the UK is about, I think we're about 50. We've got 2 offices, one in Cambridge, one up here in Macclesfield. But as part of a group, we are actually very small relative to the size of the larger Sigma group, because this is a Swedish company. Right. And then I think that's got around, it's either got 2,000 people in the whole thing or 2,000 in the division that we're in. But
wow.
Yeah, it's big in Sweden. And I had a question about the thing that you were just talking about, because sort of bringing people in to plug gaps in, you know, resourcing for projects, you know, if you haven't got a very, very long pipeline, you've got this short-term need and you bring someone in, how do you judge when the best time is? Because in that sort of situation, and quite often, we are somewhat at the whim of our clients, really, because the decision is with them to give us the work. So how do you balance bringing someone in and just hoping that they're there at the right time that the work comes in?
That's the biggest question, one of the biggest questions for running an agency is the cliff is always 3 or 4 months away, and you just have, I'm going to say something crap again, but it's a little bit of a gut feeling as to whether you think that your pipeline is going to come in or not. Mm. And if your pipeline is really big and you've got tons of things on at that point in the past, anyway, we've thought really now is the time to say, come on, we need some more help now. Headscape, we have actually, Chris and I have made a decision a year or so ago that we don't want to expand, and we will actually turn work away rather than expand now. Although it seems that we see that's what I'm saying, but actually in essence, if anything comes in, we go, oh yeah, we'll fit it in. But we have no intention of getting any bigger because we like the size we are. But in the past, it was just a kind of, yeah, it wasn't totally gut feel, but there is that gut feel based on, do you think these things are going to happen or not? Because you can't push clients into, you know, are you going to sign up in 2 months' time or whatever? Or you don't know what's just around the corner half the time as well. So you have to take a little bit of a punt on what the pipeline's going to be. But otherwise, it's like, are we coping? And if you're not, then if you're happy with where the pipeline is, but you're not coping, then it's like, well, that must add up to more people are required.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's like the more I hear questions like that, the more I realise how much you just make up as you go along.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's a question like that, which is a great question. It's a very insightful, very good question. But the truth is that there often aren't answers to things like that, is there? It's like, yeah, okay, you kind of just do what feels right at the time. It's a weird one.
I know, and the older I get, the less I'm bothered about it. It's fine.
Yeah.
You know, we've done all right. over the years. You know, if you'd asked me that question 7 or 8 years, I probably would have come up with some bullshit about figures and analysis and all that kind of thing. But, you know, actually, yeah, you can't just randomly hire people. You do have to think about it. But really, what it comes down to is the revenue going to keep coming in? And nobody knows who runs an agency. Mm. Is the honest answer to that. It might all dry up tomorrow. Mm. It probably won't, but... So it's an educated guess.
I think you're right. Therefore, a lot of this is taking a punt on a best guess.
Yeah, funny, isn't it? So, Shahina, what have you? You sent me through a couple of options of things that you wanted to talk about, both of which I thought were really good. Which one did you go for? Or did you go for something completely different?
I went for one of the ones that I sent to you. Okay. So the thing I want to talk about is taking the processes that we use to build products or websites or apps or whatever, and actually applying those to the team itself.
I'm glad you went for that one, because this made me very curious. Mm-hmm. So what did you have in your head there? What were you thinking?
So I was thinking, you know how we invest so much time and so much of our effort into the products and the services that we make. I think we should also consider spending a bit of that time and that effort into and taking ways of thinking from design practice that we're doing anyway, but applying those to crafting great teams. Mm. I was going to say, do you want to hear some of the things that I'm...
Yeah. Sorry, I keep interrupting you.
That's okay. So the first technique that I want to ask people to consider trying is to apply the syntax of the user story for communication between team members. Mm-hmm. So are you all familiar with user stories?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So user story is, I think, a great way to communicate requirements because it adds a narrative that helps everybody understand the essence of what you're trying to do. And the essence is the really important thing. So... there's a few different formats for writing a user story or articulating a user story, but I think that the ones that were developed by either Mike Cohn or maybe Rachel Davies, I think fit best to the thing I'm trying to say. So those user stories go something like this. They say, as an actor, role or persona, I want to complete a goal so that I achieve this value. I'm sort of... making my hands into square brackets as I'm reading that out loud, which doesn't work.
That works well on a podcast, good.
So often in a team when you're working on a project, you often say or you hear from someone else, you know, I need this, or, you know, maybe slightly better, you might hear, I need this by then. But I feel, you know, with that kind of phrasing, there often isn't any context for any kind of urgency. And quite critically as well, there's no shared understanding of the completeness of a task. So by that, I mean, you know, how do you both know when you've done it? Mm. And so what I would do is I'd suggest an edit to the user story syntax that I described earlier. And the one that I would suggest is something like, because I am looking for a square brackets, particular desired outcome, close square brackets, I require some kind of specific input or information, close square brackets, by square brackets, a particular time or activity. So that is, because I'm looking for a particular desired outcome, I require some kind of specific input by a particular time or activity. And I think by adapting and applying that kind of syntax to the information that you're passing between two people or even like within the team, it gives the context for why the person who's receiving that task needs to do something to help you. And I feel it leaves a bit less ambiguity for when you'd both consider that it's done. And the done bit, that goal bit of the user story is very, very important because that's when you decide that's finished and the need is met. So did you follow all of that?
Yes.
What did you think about that? Because I have a few other ideas, but it'd be good to know what you think about. Because I feel like I feel communication often has a very high failure rate within teams. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we focus a lot, especially as project managers. You know, we always talk about getting communication right with clients, etc. But typically, my experience is there is a high failure rate within organizations themselves, and I think we all suffer from that because we're all trying to do our best kind of outside, but internally, we maybe not maybe not applying that same sort of approach. And this is why, this is why I find this very interesting. We all have these techniques in our back pockets, you know, user stories, prototyping, and feedback even. And I think sort of facing them inwards a little bit and spending a bit of time with our teams can help us, if you consider the team as the product, to make that better as well.
I totally agree. It's something I've talked quite a lot about. Not so much with internal teams like that, but with clients, applying all that we know as, you know, all the effort that we put into understanding users, we don't put into understanding clients or colleagues. And actually, it's incredibly powerful. And in the set of user experience culture cards that I've been working on recently, one of the cards that I've got in there is, take the time to create empathy maps for your colleagues. So understanding what their pain points are, what influences them, you know, what their goals are, all of those kinds of things, what tasks they want to complete, what questions they've got, because it enables you to not only work with them better, but also to help them understand what you need to communicate to them. So if you think about when we do user experience design work, ultimately we're trying to convince somebody of something. We're trying to convince them to complete a call to action or to you know, purchase a product or to do whatever. But there's an element of, you know, convincing people. And one of the biggest challenges that we face internally or with clients is convincing people of stuff. And to do that, you need to understand them. So using those user experience tools that we use to understand users makes so much sense to do it with colleagues as well. I think it's brilliant. So you mentioned that you had some other things in your back pocket. Are there other examples of this?
So I'll tell you what I think about prototypes.
Yeah, because I'm struggling to imagine how that one kind of fits in.
So in my mind, a prototype tests the hypothesis. And the other thing about prototypes is they should be quick to build and quick to test as well. Mm. So what, in terms of teams, I would, you know, I always consider, well, consider how easy it could be to prototype a new way of working, for example, if, you know, your old way of working isn't doing the job, if it's failing you in any way, just try something different. Mm. And that, you know, simply that's just the build, test, learn cycle.
Mm.
And I think the way that it can apply to teams is, firstly, you know, when you have identified that some aspect of your teamwork could be better, so maybe communication or feedback loops or scheduling handovers, anything like that, if you uncover a solution that all the team members have contributed to, so, you know, if you were building a prototype, for example, that would be, you know, can this be built? Does it fulfill the user's needs? Can we design it according to brand guidelines? That kind of thing would always pass through all of the team members anyway for a sign-off, I think. Mm. It's the same with whatever your solution is to your problem that you've identified with your team. So everybody contributes to the solution. That's the first thing. And then the second step is that you decide what that solution looks like to a degree of refinement or fidelity that is just good enough. Because the key there is speed. You identify what's the problem, how do we fix it, let's just try that, rather than spending, you know, a very long time trying to refine a solution whilst you've still got that problem.
Mm.
And quickly and easily integrate whatever your new way of working is into your practice to determine if it's actually better. And then if it actually is, you can add all of the bells and whistles that you need to. Because I've had this in a previous agency. We spent a very long time determining that something needed to be fixed, and we bought some software and then spent 6 months customizing it, by which time the problem had sort of gone away or it had evolved. And that's where I think prototyping is, when applied to a team, it can just be a mindset, which is, can we do this? Yes, we can. Let's make the change now. Let's see what happens. It's, you know, it should be very quick. And that feedback, getting that feedback quickly, I think is key, because you shouldn't be stuck with a crappy way of working if you can help it.
Yeah, no, that I think is a fair comment. Yes, you don't want to be stuck with a crappy way of working. No, I think, yeah, you're right, actually. And that freedom to kind of try new things and to constantly push to innovate in the way that you work. There's a book that I recommended a couple of weeks ago on the show called Creativity Inc., which is about, written by the one of the founders of Pixar, and about their different processes and how they work and they operate, and that covers a lot of this kind of stuff as well. It's really important. We don't spend enough time on it.
Do you think it becomes more of a challenge as the company gets bigger? You know, right? Because like, I think we've chopped and changed kind of as processes and tried different things and different approaches, being a smaller agency. But do you think the bigger agencies, that as you get to like, you know, 24 people plus, it becomes more difficult to try out new processes because everybody's... Is there a scale issue, or is it just a matter of just keeping your kind of group of people that you're testing things with small, and then kind of filtering that out to the rest of the company? Does that become a challenge as the company gets bigger?
I think it can potentially be, because people want predictability, because that means that they can feel safe and comfortable in what they're doing, because things feel predictable. Yeah. And I think, especially as a project manager, it's your job to create that predictable, safe, comfortable environment so people can do the things that they're really good at without worrying about the stuff they don't need to. In terms of that scaling, I think what can help is reframing things, not as this needs to fit this process, but instead thinking of things as eventually we need this outcome, and how you get to that outcome can be flexible. And that gives, I think, more of an opportunity to be flexible with your process, because if you've all agreed what your outcome is going to be, it doesn't necessarily matter how you get there, because you've got there within whatever parameters you've set, which might be time, budget, you know, even down to using agreeing what tools you use. If you know where you're getting to, it may, you know, it shouldn't necessarily matter how you get there, and everyone ought to feel comfortable. But, you know, that's where everybody contributing helps. And it can help to do that on a project-by-project basis, to get that data and to get feedback from the team before trying to roll this out. And actually, I would always advise that, because that's another thing that doesn't work, is to sort of build a solution in a bit of an echo chamber where you say, I think this is fine, you know, around a boardroom table, and then applying it to everybody. It kind of hurts, really, because it doesn't often work.
That's what I was kind of thinking. Like, you know, there might be people that don't actually like the process, and how do you make sure that everybody's voices are heard?
Ryan, what have you brought for us today?
Right, now I had this idea of talking about this service that I've used called API Ring,
right,
which is an API documenting system. Mm-hmm. thing, and I thought, oh, I'll talk a little bit about APIs, and then I realized this could be actually such a huge talking point, so I'll try and keep it succinct. So this kind of works on the idea of I'm getting a bit developer-y, but it's documentation rather than actual code,
right? So what, first of all, what was the
API Array? So API.io.
Right, okay, yeah,
right. Now, this is a tool that allows you to basically write and document all of your API before you actually build it.
Oh!
So you work out all the endpoints you're going to have, all the functionality, what data needs to be posted to the API, and what response is going to come back. And you document all this. It's using like a description language that's kind of similar to Markdown, but has additional functionality. So you're writing it in kind of a Markdown way, but you've got additional functionality to document all this stuff. And API reuses one called API Blueprint. There is another one out there that's very popular called Swagger. So these are two kind of ways of documenting your API, and you need to kind of decide which one you're going to use, because once you've got going with it, it's kind of hard to change. But the nice thing about API is it uses that kind of markup language, the blueprint language, and you've got a nice interface that then formats it into. Have you seen Stripe's API documentation?
No, it's not something I look at a lot. API documentation, I have to be honest with you.
So one of the nicest API documentation that I've seen is Stripe.
Right.
It's really well documented, and it shows really good examples of what your endpoints are, what data you need to post to those endpoints, and what the results, what the responses that you get back. Mm-hmm. And API read kind of does that for you. So you write all your, you document all your API and all your different functionality and how things relate together and all your bits and pieces, and then it formats that into like a presented documentation. It looks really nice. It's really easy to work with. But one of the nice things that it's got as well is you can actually test your built API. So you do all this before you've even started building your API.
Yeah.
And then you build your API based on what you've written in your what you've documented. So you build into a plan.
Yes.
You're not just going off half-cocked. Yeah. And what you can then do is you can test your API against your documentation. So what it'll do is, because you've defined all your API and your documentation, you can say, right, my API is over there, run through and test and make sure you can hit all these different endpoints and make sure that these are the responses you get back.
Ooh.
So you can actually test your API against what you've documented, which is nice, because if you change your API and then you break something, you can either fix it or you can go back to your documentation and update your documentation to say, right, we've now added this bit in, and make sure that your documentation's up to date all the time as well.
And that is so important, the number of times that documentation don't match what happens in reality.
Yeah. So yeah, absolutely. And so it's quite a nice tool. We used it for a system that we've been building internally, and one of the nice things about taking an API kind of driven approach is you're building your system API before you're getting into building a web interface or a mobile app or anything else. You're just building the functionality of your system first. And the advantage of that is then that you can use that API to build whatever, you know, interfaces you want. So you can build your web interface, you can build a mobile interface, you can build an interface for your TV. Whatever you want to do, you've started with the core functionality before you've even got into any markup, JavaScript, anything like that, because you're just building your API, which handles the processing of the data. So API was just a tool I wanted to kind of bring to light today. It's recently been bought by
Oracle.
Yeah. So I don't know where it's going to go from here, but yeah, it's quite a nice tool.
I like that idea of starting with the documentation. That's an interesting way of doing it.
Yeah. So there's a concept in development called test-driven development. The idea being that you write a test and then you code to make that test pass.
Okay.
So you write a test that fails, and then you write your bit of code to make the test pass.
Right.
And then you refactor your code, make it as good as it can, make sure the test still passes, and then move on to the next one. The reason being is you're building really solid code, then, rather than just building things half-cocked that's untestable. You're building in small chunks. This is kind of that kind of concept, but this is more, it makes sure that you plan everything and you document everything, and you're making sure, because it's so important if you're building an API to have it well documented, because otherwise how do you know what it does?
Yeah.
So that's what this tool does. So I've tried to keep that kind of as succinct as possible.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's so much you can talk about with APIs, but from a conceptual point of view, this is just documenting an API and then building to that documentation.
Because you could, I mean, that the whole idea of starting by building the API and then the different interfaces on top of it, I mean, that's a whole talk and book probably in itself, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely, but that's how also if you just get into a code editor and just start coding, that's how you end up with spaghetti code and tangents and all kinds of stuff, and it becomes this. And so many things make it to market that have been built in that way, and then you suddenly 2 years will pass and version 2 is out where they've built it properly.
Yeah.
You know, they've just started again from scratch.
Yeah.
So I'm quite keen on do it right the first time and then iterate. But this is quite a nice tool if you're building an API and you want to start off doing it properly.
Cool. You need to do us a talk for next season, Ryan, on APIs. I would love to hear that. Even though I don't do anything, I don't code this stuff. I've always loved the principle of APIs and the approach. So yeah, it'd be good. Andy, what have you got for us?
Sorry, I was just sugaring my lightning cable while I was listening to that.
I don't know what that word means.
Sugru is ace.
What's sugru?
It's like a little sort of putty compound that you well, it turns into rubber after about half an hour.
Okay.
And you use it for basically fixing things. So I've just been sitting there while I was listening to Ryan's API talk. I was just fixing a lightning cable with some Sugru.
Oh, I've just looked it up on Amazon, Sugru. Oh, there you go.
Brilliant.
The girl, I can't remember her name. Do you remember who invented Sugru?
No.
Andy?
No.
No. She spoke at the Brighton conference, Reasons to be Creative, and she talked about the whole history of how she made Sugru. It was really interesting, really fancy. I think everybody got the phone that and just ordered some as soon as she'd finished talking. Everyone went, that is cool.
Interesting.
I had some mailed all the way down here to Australia. Anyway.
Right,
My segment. Do you remember a few weeks ago I talked about the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's graphic standards manual? And Paul loved it so much that I'm sure he ordered quite a few on Kickstarter. Anyway, turns out that they didn't actually hit their funding goal.
Oh, what a shocker.
But what they've done is they've found out that they can actually get better prints, they've found out cheaper costs, etc., etc. So they've now basically lowered the pledge. There's a mailing list to sign up for to find out about the new Kickstarter when it comes out. So please do that, because I want to add that to my collection. There'll be a link in to show notes. Right, on to my actual topic for the day, which is not Sugru and the Graphic Standards Manual from Canada. I've been working on a new style guide design here at Ansarada, and I put together a few kind of, you know, sketches, very lo-fi in terms of what I wanted to do with this layout, and I started to put it together in code earlier on today, and I thought, why am I even bothering thinking about floats or any other type of layout? I should go straight for CSS grid, which, of course, is what I did, and I went from, like, a quick sketch on a piece of A4 paper to a responsive, flexible grid layout in about 45 seconds. It was amazing. Now, this is not the most complicated grid layout that I'm sure anyone's made, but I tell you what, it was just brilliant. And that's it. I'm sold. And there's been quite a lot of people talking about grid this past week, because of basically browsers catching up, and I think it's only now Edge, which still just has a preview implementation of CSS Grid. But it's brilliant, and what you really, really need to do is to go and learn about CSS Grid. I'm not mucking about. You need to do it now. It needs to be your week. This needs to be your CSS Grid week, because if you're not up with the cool kids on CSS Grid, then you just, a whole nother has been, like Paul, you need to learn it. So where are you going to learn it from? You're going to learn it from two great sources, I think. The first is gridbyexample.com, which is a website that's been set up by Rachel Andrew. And she's not only been working on the W3C to get CSS Grid implemented properly, but she's also been making some really, really great learning materials, including a bunch of videos. Just before Christmas, like every day for about 12 days, she posted a new video about CSS Grid, and you can see that on gridbyexample.com/video, which is excellent. And there's also a gallery of common layout patterns, which I wish I'd found before I started coding my own up today, because I might have actually trimmed it down to like 25 seconds if I'd have just cut and paste her code. Anyway, the other person that's been really working on presenting CSS Grid stuff is Jen Simmons. She's got some really interesting examples if you go to labs.jensimmons.com. And something which I thought was a hell of a lot of fun was, there's a guy called Thomas Park, who is Thomas H. Park on Twitter. He's from Philadelphia. And he's put together CSSGridGarden.com.
That's what I'm sitting here playing with that now, actually.
A game that teaches you about CSS Grid while you write your CSS code and you grow your carrot garden. And it's just 28 levels of fun CSS code that will teach you all about grid. So this has got to be your week for grid. I've had it.
The grid garden is strangely addictive. I can't stop playing it.
This is my week for grid then.
This is your week for a grid, Chuck.
Okay, that's fine. I just sent that email to my boss. Okay, done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all you have to do this week.
Everything is rearranged. Okay.
Yeah, that's good to know. The logical question is, can I actually start using this yet, Andy? Is this all latest browser stuff?
Well, it is latest browser stuff, if all you care about is latest browsers. Edge is the only issue, really, and I suppose IE11 is still kind of knocking around for some people. Of course, you can combine it with things like at supports, so that you can write some sort of nice quarantined fallbacks. Mm-hmm. Fallback to something, you know, logical. But, you know, I think you can, at this stage in the game, I think you could be fairly aggressive. And if you just drop back to, you know, one or two columns for crappy old browsers, then that's going to be all right. But,
right.
You know, the gains that you'll make from, you'll actually end up using way, way, way less media queries and breakpoints and all that kind of stuff if you just use Grid and Flexbox. It really does simplify things a lot, and you can do some really cool layouts with it.
I'm sitting here playing the grid garden thing, and it's got some interesting... I don't know if I fully understand what I'm doing. So you've got... Well, it doesn't matter, actually. Trying to describe this in an audio podcast is not going to work. And also, supporting my idiocy is probably not the place to do it in the show. Now,
Although it could be quite interesting.
It could. But because I'm sitting here going, hang on a minute, grid column start is 5 and grid column end is 2. How can it be less than it was starting? What's going on? So, yeah, that's fine.
Lots of cool stuff. And, of course, all the books that I've been talking about for this whole season have all been about inspiration for grid. So there is a bit of method in my madness.
See, you're making it sound like you planned it all when you hadn't. Don't give us that. Yeah, exactly. That's what I thought. All right, well, I've got a quickie to wrap up with, which is a tool that I use regularly. One of the things that I've been quite shocked at as I work with a lot of my clients, and clients that are producing large amounts of content, right? Content that goes out on social media, that goes out via email, podcasts, blog posts, you name it. There's so many different types of content on so many different channels we put out these days. And like big organizations that are putting out huge amounts of content, yet have no centralized method of managing this, right? So one of the clients I work with, you know, has got millions of subscribers and followers on various platforms and that kind of stuff. And social media updates, blog posts, they're all just kind of put out whenever by different people across the organization with no kind of coordination at all. It just blows my mind. So, I work by myself and I still have an editorial calendar which controls what goes out when. So that all of this kind of stuff is coordinated. And the way that I do that is using a tool called CoSchedule. CoSchedule is a great tool. I used to use lots of different tools, but I've kind of now just brought it all down to this one tool that does all of it. And it's essentially, it gives you a calendar. And on that calendar, you can integrate CoSchedule with everything you can possibly imagine. WordPress, Evernote, Buffer, Twitter, Facebook, anything, you name it. And you have this one calendar to rule them all. So you can basically go in and create a blog post on your WordPress blog, right? And you drop it into a particular date. And then you can add a link in. So for me, I know I have a blog post every Tuesday, and I can go through and I can outline what topics I want to cover on what date, you know, each Tuesday. And then I know I've got a podcast that goes out every Thursday, so that goes into my calendar as well. I know I've got a newsletter that goes out every other Friday, so that goes into the calendar. And I can see all this kind of stuff laid out. And then with each one of those items, like, for example, in a blog post goes out, I can associate social media updates for it. So I can say that, that immediately as soon as my blog post goes out, send out an update, right? But then also send it out 8 hours later, okay? Because, for America. Also then send out another post the next day, and then in a week, and then in a month. And it fills all of this in the calendar. And so you've got this kind of nice kind of calendar of all of these different things filled in. But then what you can do on top of it is you can then have lists of other social media updates, you know, kind of evergreen content or whatever else. And you can basically say, fill in the gaps with this kind of stuff, right? So you've got stuff that's fixed. Then you've got stuff that it kind of puts in automatically. And it's just such a neat way of seeing what's going out when and stopping you kind of just overwhelming people with content all at once. It even does things like analyze your headlines of your blog posts to make sure they're as effective as possible. So it's a really good tool that I think, whether you use CoSchedule or whether you use an Excel spreadsheet, I think pretty much anybody that is using social media or content marketing in any kind of professional sense needs a tool like this. So, yes, that's my suggestion for the day. Okay, that's left everybody speechless. Nobody
else.
I love
the sound of it.
Sorry, what was that?
No, I'm just flicking through.
Yeah, it sounds great because I have a terrible approach to remembering to tweet and blog. I don't blog, to be honest, but tweet and stuff. And the time I remember is when I'm about to go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll write the tweet and put it in my dress and then try and remember the next day to post it. Never do. So this sounds like it might solve some of my problems.
Well, actually, in your situation, I'd recommend a slightly different tool. This would probably be a bit of a sledgehammer to crack a nut for your situation, because it's just you and it's mainly just tweets. You don't have lots of different channels. So in your case, I'd suggest a tool called Buffer. Have you come across Buffer?
Do you know what? People keep saying Buffer.
Yeah.
I should look into this.
Buffer's really good because I suffer from the same problem. I do exactly the same. I sit in bed. I know you shouldn't do, but I do. I sit in bed at night and I read all these articles and stuff, or I go through Twitter and I see all these cool things that I want to share. And of course, what happens is you end up then just spamming people with loads of updates all within about half an hour of one another. So what you do instead is you add them to Buffer and it will spread them out over a period of a day. So you can put them all in one go, but then it kind of pushes them out over the day. So yeah, a couple of...
So what that basically means is if you follow Paul, it's just a robot.
Yeah, I am. In terms of when you receive my updates, but they're all still written by me. It's just that something, it schedules them for me. So I'm being considerate and not...
Is Dieselbot.
Don't stop it.
Dieselbot.
Is that going to be the title of...
So if I reply to a scheduled tweet and there's no reply, it's actually Dieselbot that's ignoring me?
Yes.
Not, okay.
I do still have to keep an eye on it in terms of replying to people. And I'm going, what the hell are they replying to? Because, of course, I can't remember what it was that I said in the first place. But there you go. Other than that, it's totally spontaneous and real. But, no, it's a useful tool. Anyway, talking of useful tools, let's quickly talk about Proposify before we wrap up this week's show. Proposify is a simpler way of delivering proposals for your clients. So it streamlines your sales process and helps you to close deals faster. In fact, they've worked out, I don't know how they worked this out, but I think they just made it up, right? That apparently users save over 2 hours for each proposal compared to using Word, InDesign or Google Docs. To be honest, I can believe that, actually. That does sound feasible. After using Proposify for a while, it's a hell of a lot simpler than writing proposals in Word or whatever. You make sure it also helps you make sure that your sales leads never go cold, because it allows you to track those leads and see how they're performing, and it puts your proposals in the hands of your clients faster, because it's got this you can produce them so much quicker with their great editor they've got and reusable content libraries, etc. But most of all, actually, and this is really useful, people can look at those proposals anywhere, anytime. So it's not like sending a Word document where they have to wait till they're a laptop. These are all web-based proposals, which means that they can go and look at them online. They can even sign them online as well, which on average means that proposals get signed off about 60% faster than if you send them, you know, documents that go backwards and forwards and all that kind of stuff. So it really is a very useful tool for getting proposals to clients and getting them to sign off on them. You can find out more about it at proposify.biz/BoagWorld. Marcus, please tell me you're using Bruce Lawson's joke.
I have Bruce Lawson's joke ready to go.
Yes, because this really made me giggle.
I smeared some ketchup all over my eyes once. It was a bad idea in hindsight.
See?
Hindsight.
He did another one this morning. I'm just trying to remember what it was. It was something about... Oh, I'm going to completely butcher this now, aren't I? Because I can't remember what his joke is. I'm going to have to actually look it up. It was just
tried to eat a clock for breakfast. It was very time consuming.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah. Sorry. Anyway, that's it for this week. Don't forget Lightning Talks for next season. I'm getting quite excited. People have started to contact me now. We're beginning to build some momentum. People that are going to do some talks for next season on the show. I hope you will be one of them. We just need so many of them. It's unbelievable. So get those lightning talks coming in. You can find out more about what's involved in doing that at boag.world/season18. Please check that out and submit those as soon as possible. That's it for this week's show. Join us again next week, where we're going to be doing the very last show of this season. So until then, goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.